Jesus' teaching ministry begins with the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 1 to 12. Today we will be reading this text, often known as the Beatitudes, from the interpreter Eugene Peterson from The Message. When Jesus saw his ministry drawing huge crowds, he climbed a hillside. Those who were apprenticed to him, the committed, climbed with him. Arriving at a quiet place, he sat down and taught his climbing companions. This is what he said.
You're blessed when you're at the end of your rope.
With less of you, there is more of God and his role.
You're blessed when you feel you've lost what is most dear to you.
Only then can you be embraced by the one most dear to you.
You're blessed when you're content with just who you are, no more, no less.
That's the moment you find yourselves proud owners of everything that can't be bought.
You're blessed when you've worked up a good appetite for God.
He's food and drink and the best meal you'll ever eat.
You're blessed when you care.
At the moment of being careful, you find yourselves cared for.
You're blessed when you get inside world, your mind and your heart put right.
Then you can see God in the outside world.
You're blessed when you can show people how to cooperate instead of compete or fight.
That's when you discovered who you really are and your place in God's family.
You're blessed when your commitment to God provokes persecution. The persecution drives you even deeper into God's kingdom.
Not only that, count yourselves blessed. Every time people put you down or throw you out or speak lies about you to discredit me. What it means is that the truth is too close for comfort and they are uncomfortable. You can be glad when that happens. Give a cheer. For though they don't like it, I do. And all heaven applauds. And know that you are in good company. My prophets and witnesses have always gotten into this kind of trouble.
So Jesus gathered his disciples around him to teach. In this first story of teaching, I can imagine that the disciples were continuing to want to learn just what Jesus expected of them. What were their requirements for this life? What have I done to leave the work that I was so familiar with, they must have asked, and follow you? What does this mean? And it's a question for each of us. What does the Lord require of us? We can easily discard that question when life is going well and we breeze into the next party or class or phase of our life. But sooner or later, and certainly this week has been one of those times, when the question rears its head, I believe, and we're alert enough to hear it. I believe the question is pressing for every one of us. On that mountain, a place of healing and teaching and perspective, Jesus asked the disciples to take a very close look, to look at those around them differently than the culture did. And if we truly stop to think about it, isn't it interesting that Jesus urges his disciples to recognize that you aren't to judge others like the culture does? But Jesus commands or even says it is required that we see people's character. And rather than measuring people by their possessions, we must see who they really are on the inside. And rather than judge their failings, we are invited to forgive and remind them that they are born to make a difference in this world. As we gather around Jesus with the disciples this morning, we're invited to recognize that God always comes when we least expect God to be. Jesus points us to recognize that God's kingdom isn't a place very far away, but it is found wherever we honor each other as God's children, or when we bear each other's burden, when we bind each other's wounds and meet each other's needs. On Friday, the president of our country closed our nation's borders to refugees, ordering that families fleeing slaughter and certain death in Syria be indefinitely blocked from entering the United States, and temporarily suspending immigration from several predominantly Muslim countries. Confusion and chaos has been boiling this weekend in international airports. Two Iraqi men, one of whom has worked for the U.S. government for more than 10 years, and one who is a legal refugee joining his wife and son, were detained at JFK for no other reason than this presidential order. But people gathered up and began to stand up and sing. At the San Francisco airport, a large gathering of folks joined with great energy and singing that beautiful chorus, like the singing from Sweet Honey on the Rock. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. And I hear from many of you, what are we to do in this complex and anxious time? And I do believe that we know it in our veins. I witness it pulsing among us. We do already know, for God has told us, go back to the basics. We who believe that freedom cannot rest until it comes. From the prophet Micah, we hear that God indeed has something for us to do in response to and in cooperation with God. It means getting right down to basics: justice, kindness, walking humbly with God. We can use these simple words as this kind of plumb line, I believe, for our beliefs and practices and ethical rules to measure how well they align with God's vision. And we are continuing to try to translate these simple instructions into very concrete realities for our complicated day-to-day lives. Ed Thorne is a writer in the Storyteller's Companion to the Bible, and he describes the three requirements from Micah as preserving the rights of all in the community. He says, kindness is to love in God's timeless and unconditional way. And walking humbly with God is to be aware of one's need for God, who walks as our partner throughout our lives. And it's a personal walk, but it's also a communal walk. We must walk with one another. We need each other for the path and God's presence with us as well. We need community to help us find and stay on that path. And what God requires is a life of engagement with others in the quest for justice and mercy in a world that clamors for hatred with a vengeance. And we can even approach these words as a blessing. Many of you know that a week ago I had the privilege of being part of a 7-day silent retreat in Warnersville, Pennsylvania, at the Jesuit Center for Spiritual Growth. Along with about 20 men and women, we were with one another in silence as we ate and worshiped and prayed. Each of us met with a spiritual director for an hour eat once a day, and we are invited to worship as the body in the daily Catholic Mass. The first night, we met one another and talked with our small group, with the director that would lead us that week. And I learned very quickly from that initial conversation that one of the women in my group, age 70, had recently retired following her life as a nun, and she was leaning towards Buddhist teachings, and she had worked in prisons and health care, advocating for drug addicts, and she was searching for what God was calling her to next. She was my next-door neighbor, and her prayer during Mass on the day of inauguration touched me so deeply as she spoke out for the vulnerable, for immigrants. I sent her a note to let her know the impact of her words, and as I was preparing to leave a week ago Saturday, she defied the usual pattern of sitting individually alone at those stately wooden cafeteria tables. But she came and sat right next to me. And in silence, we ate our last supper together. For we were sisters, and we were bonded without hardly any words. We've exchanged emails, and Teresa is a blessing. William Brown assures us that walking humbly is not a lonely path, but rather it is the path of the worshiping community, both past as well as present. And again, we need this community to help us find and stay on this path, for the true piety is not a private affair like this one strolling along a beach with God right beside them. But what God requires is a life of engagement with others in this quest for justice and mercy. So we are blessed as we join together. Teresa and I were not part of the Women's March, which occurred weekend before last, but we were marching in prayer and spirit. And I've certainly heard criticism, but some of you today can testify to the power of that community, the crowds that gathered for that powerful event, the Women's March. About 100 people from Huntington attended. Crowds well exceeded the estimations, 500,000 in D.C., 175,000 in Boston, 150,000 in Chicago, 100,000 in Seattle. And images showed gatherings all around the world. Many declared that all people are valued and we are called to bless one another, to offer God's justice and mercy and righteousness to all God's children. One UCC leader said, "Saturday's worldwide witness was historic and significant. But now comes the test. Now the hard work begins. Now comes the painstaking, far less visible work of educating and organizing and mobilizing for systemic institutional change on the local, regional, national, and international level. Now is the time to forge partnerships, coalitions and networks for sustained long-term change-making. And now is the time for justice advocates to engage in the manner of decision-making forums, from school board meetings to corporate board meetings to newspaper and television editorial board meetings. The true consequence of Saturday's massive global witness hinges on what we do as justice advocates in the days and the months ahead." Our Church of the Brethren, General Secretary David Steele, has signed a letter to the President and members of Congress expressing support for refugee resettlement. And the letter, which has now been signed by more than 2,000 religious leaders from across the country, is an initiative from the Interfaith Immigration Coalition. The letter begins like this: "As religion leaders from a variety of backgrounds, we are called by our sacred text and faith traditions to love our neighbor, accompany the vulnerable, and welcome the sojourner. War, conflict, and persecution have forced people to leave their homes, creating more refugees asylum seekers, and international displaced people than any other time in history. More than 65 million people are currently displaced. The letter is an articulate cry for justice and loving kindness. Some of you have already posted excellent challenges for many of us on social media, to write to our Congress people, to make phone calls, to speak out for the vulnerable, for all of God's children. And some Junietta students have an ambitious plan to help all of us advocate for those who are blessed by meeting here at Stone Church on Thursday evening. 500 postcards are already prepared for us to write notes and express our beliefs in the dignity of humankind. You are invited to come, to be part of a powerful movement of action. And of course, you are encouraged to write letters and make your own phone calls. You can do it on your own, but what if many of us showed up and let those students know that we at Stone Church are serious about having our voice heard, that we are not only providing the space, but we are offering support and prayers and are part of a community that is blessed to reach out to those who mourn and hunger and thirst. What if some of those students could witness that God's kingdom is found right here? And we are certainly always called to pray, to speak out, to pray with our actions and our longings for kingdom justice, for kindness, for walking humbly. Again, God's kingdom isn't a place far away, but it is found wherever we honor each other as God's children, where we bear each other's burdens, where we bind each other's wounds, where we meet needs. To be human is to be inescapably fragile and vulnerable. And it turns out that the surprising character of God isn't to reject these things, but rather to gather them all in a loving, divine embrace. Kayla McClurg wisely writes, "We are not in control of life, the difficulties or the blessings, but we can learn to expect them and to receive them as guests, as guides, as friends who come to show us the blessing path. Yes, we have requirements, and we have many, many blessings. May we work together to shower God's blessings for everyone at God's table. Amen."